everyone, and welcome to Filmstrips, the podcast that would just like to note that, what's a Yossarian? I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Carnegie, sir. And boy, I just flew in from the Mediterranean, and boy are my arms tired. Dave, who are we and what are we doing with everybody's time this week? And before you change that dial, it is a return to the proper series continuity.
Yes, I was going to say, this is Filmstrips, the podcast in which each and every week we take a look at a film, look at the nuance, the subtext, the paratext, spoil the ever-loving hell out of it. The important thing is that each and every film under discussion must somehow connect back to the film we were discussing upon the preceding episode. Except that for the last about month and a half, close to 2 months worth of episodes, we do the show weekly if you're turning in for the first time. We sort of had to put a pin in that and did a series of bonus episodes due to the joys of real life there and just having some scheduling things that we needed to work out that way. But we're back, baby, to quote Telly Savalas, as we all should in this instance.
Back and parentheses around better than ever?
Okay, yeah, let's not oversell this.
We'll know by the end.
Indeed. But going back way a while back then, what was our last proper episode taking a look at there, Andrew?
Well, I believe the last film we looked at was Arthur Hiller's incredibly delightful The In-Laws with Peter Falk, longtime friend and fave of the show, as well as other longtime friend and fave of the show, Alan Arkin, who... Or did we look at Inspector Clouseau first?
I think Clouseau was our last one.
Okay, that explains probably why I needed a break and why I don't remember that. But we have decided to follow Alan Arkin to maybe loftier pastures than trying to be the Erstad's replacement for Peter Sellers. And we have decided to follow him to 1970s Mike Nichols film Catch 22, based on the very famous novel by Joseph Heller, featuring a script by Buck Henry, my man, and a cast that includes, but is not limited to, Alan Arkin, Martin Balsam, Richard Benjamin, Art Garfunkel, Bob Newhart, Anthony Perkins, Martin Sheen, John Voight, Bob Balaban, and Orson Welles.
Yes, this is indeed a who's who of Hollywood. Except for many of these people, they weren't quite the who's who yet, but would become. And for some of them, they were the who's of yesterday at a certain point in time. And plus Art Garfunkel. But
and Norman Fell. Oh, and Charles Grodin. This movie's terrific.
Yeah, and only about half the cast is dead. But we are tempting fate with the other part of this show where we inadvertently get people killed by just happening to bring them up on this program.
Yeah, so, if you are tuning in for the first time, there is a good chance anyone that we discuss in a given episode will die within a month. That's been happening with alarming regularity, actually. That's not entirely the reason why we took a little bit of a break, but I'm not going to lie. And hey, Spider-Man, everyone's talking about that, and it's important to remember. Great power, and so on.
But with that, yes, we are turning our attention to Catch 22. A rather infamous film, I think, is probably the best way to putting it.
An infamous and somewhat forgotten film, certainly compared to the enduring success and popularity of Joseph Heller's novel, which I think it would not be a misstatement to say that it is one of those books that really kind of captures the zeitgeist. And there's a reason phrases like Catch 22 have entered popular usage in that. But all that to say, though, is given the outsized importance this book used to have, I think there's a very real question where more than 50 years after it came out, whether anybody actually knows what Catch 22 is. And for that, I think it's time for Dave to do what he does best and get us all up to speed with The Rundown.
Catch-22 is the 1970 dark comedy adaptation of the famous 1961 novel by Joseph Heller. Directed by Mike Nichols from a screenplay by Buck Henry, the film stars Alan Arkin as a World War II bomber as he navigates the madness of war while trying to find some form of escape. Met with mixed critical reviews at the time of its release, Catch-22 was a box office disappointment, despite a high-profile cast and crew. The novel was later adapted for television in 2019, to somewhat stronger critical reception. Coming up after film strips, an episode of NBC's short-lived sitcom Bukowski, based on the life of Charles Bukowski, starring John Lovitz.
So, anybody who on the break was tempted to look up contemporary reviews of this film will probably know that it certainly seemed like at the time the biggest talking point is something we were saying before we started recording. We heard all the time when we were kids, and you don't really hear all that much anymore, but the sentiment that, well, it's not as good as the book. And that also sort of calls to mind the other idea of some books just simply can't be filmed. I think we brought up examples, Mark Daniluski's House of Leaves, or stories that require the medium of literature in order to tell the story that they're telling. We'll unpack that a bit as we go on. But I think in this case, though, the film very much kind of exists in the shadow of Heller's novel. And that's probably a good starting point. For those of you who haven't read it, Joseph Heller starts writing Catch-22 in the 1950s. It's published in 1961. And I mean, at heart, what it's trying to do is sort of easy to take for granted in 2021, especially in the context of ongoing developments in the Middle East, which we'll try not to talk about any more than we have to. But I mean, I think for many, especially in the post-World War II, pre-Vietnam period, a story that really at heart is about the absurdity of warfare and combat, and the human condition against this backdrop, was really eye-opening for a lot of people. Because, I mean, you can look at, say, Hemingway and For Whom the Bell Tolls, and the idea that war is somewhat romantic. Or you can look at something like All Quiet on the Western Front and get the sentiment of war is hell. The same year that this film comes out, you have Robert Altman's MASH, which is very much war is kind of funny. And Catch-22, I think it's best understood not necessarily as a funny novel, but one that's really committed to the premise of absurdity.
Yeah, and while I will definitely push back a little bit on your interpretation of MASH, at least the original Altman film.
It ends with a football game, Dave, come on.
We will get into that one day. But the point of the matter here is, I have to admit, I have not read the novel itself. So I can't speak to the novel, but that is my understanding from people's general impressions of it there. So I'm going all along with the fact that, yeah, that does seem to be the case. And I've seen select passages from it.
I haven't read in about 15 years, but I mean, they're the big things that stick with you. And I mean, sort of the absurdity of Heller's view of warfare is neatly encapsulated by the title. So without spoiling anything for anyone, the Catch-22 is basically the one condition where airmen fighting in World War II would be grounded and then sent back home. And it's the premise that, well, anybody who gets into an airplane and flies over anti-aircraft weaponry and, gets into aerial dogfights, you would have to be crazy in order to volunteer for that. However, if you say that you're crazy, that's a rational assessment of what's going on. And if you can identify that, that means you're sane, and then you have to keep flying. And that's the Catch-22 that our main character, protagonist Yossarian, finds himself grappling against.
Yeah, exactly. And really, I mean, boiling it down, yeah, the inability to escape war as sort of the fundamental nature of what this text will in some ways be about. And particularly how we choose to interpret the ending of the film as well. But we'll get there. But yeah, I mean, certainly it's one of those things where, as a phrase, it has sort of disseminated into popular culture at large, with most people not necessarily being aware maybe where it comes from these days. I would say
These days it's more sort of associated with damned if you do, damned if you don't, right?
Yeah, yeah, one way or the other, you cannot escape it. But yeah, so I mean, you know, you have to have had a major significant impact to do this, but as you noted, Andrew, this was a novel that was often viewed as unfilmable. And I mean, having been the one who at least read it at some point in time, why is that generally held to be the case?
The structure of the book is very strange. I remember it's non-linear. It jumps around in time, and you know, it's a bit fuzzy, but like in the film, though, we also realize that a lot of what's motivating Yossarian and his anxiety, what we would probably now term PTSD, is actually something that happens long before, you know, in plot time. He basically ends up witnessing one of his crewmen not only die, but horrifically turns him over and sees his guts falling out. Snowden, which makes it all the more poetic that Edward Snowden did what he did as well. Life imitates art sometimes. But it's sort of the idea that, as you were saying, that it's also not just a story about war, but that there's an inescapability in the human condition being expressed against this backdrop. But it also tonally is very... I can see why it's very easy in some respects to write with a flat tonality. Being able to film that and put together a cast who can perform that carries a lot of risk. And I mean, a lot of the criticism of this film is that it's almost too slapsticky, or that it doesn't sort of balance those registers effectively. Again, that's sort of speaking to the fact that a film is different than a novel. They are different artistic mediums, and there are things you can do in one that you just necessarily can't do in the other. Maybe the go-to example for that is Alan Moore's Watchmen compared to Zack Snyder's Watchmen. I have gone on record to say that I think Zack Snyder's Watchmen is a fantastic film. But in order to make the film that they make, they basically have to cut out all of the paratext that Moore includes in his book. Because unless you're going to have like 15-minute sequences of characters reading in-universe publications and things to color in the world, you just can't do that on film. So, you know, choices have to be made. And for a long time, especially given the overwhelmingly positive critical reception that Heller's novel had, there's very much a reluctance to even try. I'm trying to find out how many, if there were any earlier attempts to do that. Just looking it over here. So the book comes out in 1961, and the film rights get sold to Columbia in 1962. But I think it's kind of telling that the film doesn't come out until 1970. And, well, the film that we end up getting, the people who are making it are kind of facing their own internal pressures, not just in Heller's book. And that brings us to our director of this sordid tale, one Igor Mikhail Preshkowski, a.k.a. Mike Nichols. But Mike Nichols, at this point in time, is riding off a pretty high wave, and that's the film The Graduate, a.k.a. Mrs. Robinson, the movie. But The Graduate, which, again, I'll go on record and say one of the 10 best American films ever made, Nichols ends up approaching this as his follow-up project, and I think he does make a shrewd move, and that's collaborating once again with one of the most criminally underrated writers and comic performers, Buck Henry, who co-wrote The Graduate with him and co-writes the screenplay for this movie.
Exactly.
And also appears as Colonel Korn.
Yeah, and, you know, Buck Henry, I mean, he was closely associated with many different comedic talents of the time. He would go on to write films such as What's Up, Doc, Protocol, and The Humbling. But he also, if I'm not mistaken, had a long collaboration with Mel Brooks as well for some time. So, I mean...
Oh, did they do... what was it?
Get Smart. I believe that that was theirs. I'm going to double check that so I can cut this out if I'm completely wrong. But yeah, I mean, Henry is...
He also did Heaven Can Wait, though that comes out 8 years after this.
Exactly.
And decidedly a different tone than Catch-22. But for those of you who have seen both films, I think what's striking is that one is a story about a young, jaded college grad coming home and figuring himself out in a rapidly changing world. The other is about World War II and a bunch of frustrated, sexually repressed airmen trying to make it through the day. And there seems to be a weirdly similar tone across both films.
Yeah, which basically means that, yes, Catch-22 is indeed the Mallrats of its generation. But... I make no apologies for that joke, folks. But yeah, but I mean, but you know, to actually go with that there, I mean, for a second, I mean, certainly, you know, what's Michael Nichols is coming up against in this instance is basically the same frustration that many, many, many filmmakers will face once you have a mega hit film that is a cultural sensation like The Graduate was, which is basically the follow-up blues or lack of failure. Nichols is not the only one to have gone through this, along with the previously mentioned Kevin Smith. There's also, I mean, certainly Michael Mann. He came out the gate swinging with Thief in 1981, and his follow-up to that was The Keep from 1983, which I'm fond of. James is fond of. Many people, not so much.
Is anyone else?
Not really.
Yeah. And I mean, the same way, though, like, by that same token, it's, what was the character? Or what was the novel? Not Something Happened. What's it called? Because Heller himself ended up struggling, not maybe to the same extent, but he certainly had struggles following up his literary career, because it's sort of that sense of, well, you hit it big, and you're never going to hit it nearly as big ever again. And yeah, in 1994, he ends up writing the novel Closing Time, that's the one, which ends up being a sequel to Catch-22, and like the film under discussion, basically, nobody seems to remember that.
Yeah, he truly is the Mario Puzo, also of the literary scene. See, that joke, follow-up, not
as
good.
The thinking man's Hannibal Rising.
fair.
Yeah, but so there's a lot of curses, I think, or not necessarily curses, but certainly a lot of pressures against this film, to which, hats off to Nichols and Henry, because they... surely must have been aware of that, but they still tried anyway. And from what I gather, it ends up being a pretty troubled production. My understanding is the film was made for about $17 million. It makes about $25 back, but when you learn some of the details, you can see why it wouldn't be seen as a great return on investment. Apparently, they had originally slated 6 weeks to film the flight sequences. It ended up taking closer to 6 months. They tried to use as many authentic World War II model airplanes as they could for authenticity, which, I mean, 25 years after the fact is a bit of a gamble. The second unit director died because he didn't want to wear a harness and fell out of an airplane. And, yeah, they ended up using 17 B-25s and filmed largely on location in Mexico. And, yeah, it just seems like it was a case of maybe, not so much like a commitment to a vision, as much as we've talked about, like, one way that directors often try and expand upon the hit is going bigger and better and a broader scale than ever before. And, well, predictably, that brings a whole host of problems with it, too. And otherwise, as far as, like, cast and crew, it seems like everybody got along. Apparently, the first choice to play Yossarian was Al Pacino, Which, given what this film ends up being, I don't think would have worked as well as Alan Arkin.
Hard to say. I would imagine with Pacino there, this would be a much more directly dramatic film with him, because I don't think he's got that sort of sardonic approach, even when he's doing the sort of fast talking shtick, particularly 1960s, early 1970s Pacino. Like, this
Yeah,
is.
he had to grow into that. You get it in Sea of Love. I don't think you would get that here. Though now I'm picturing him grabbing John Voight by the cheeks and being like, "Milo, you broke my heart."
Yeah, not quite that. But yeah, I mean, we get Alan Arkin here, and admittedly, yeah, the cast that we've previously mentioned is a rather eclectic group. We had people that would go on to mass successes, such as the late Charles Grodin, may he rest in peace, here, long before he did Clifford. We also have, Richard Benjamin, future a director himself. Who would go on to direct, I believe it was Macy X, the infamous Damon Wayans, Lisa Kudrow film.
Marcy X? Oh my God, that's one of those films I think about once a year, and then I remind myself I'm glad I didn't rent it.
Yeah, we also have, yes, Buck Henry himself in the cast. We've got Art Garfunkel, who, again, people have to remember in the context, if you only know Art Garfunkel as that dude who rode Paul Simon's coattails,
Yeah, the tall one.
exactly. I mean, it's the old go-to joke, but the truth of the matter is, Art Garfunkel, love or hate him, was a big figure in 1960s, late 60s, early 70s culture.
It also makes sense given that The Graduate famously had the contemporary soundtrack provided by Simon and Garfunkel.
Exactly. And John Voight, who we've previously discussed on Mission Impossible and future father of Angelina Jolie,
Those damn Gideons.
yeah, long before he completely lost the script in the real world, I mean, he turns up here in delivering one hell of a performance. And keep in mind, this is right around the same time as Midnight Cowboy, which I think had come out a year previously to this.
I believe you're
Yeah,
correct,
and
yeah.
would been, one of the, the big award winners at the Oscars for that year, including being the one and only film for an X to be nominated and I think win Best Picture. So,
You are correct.
yeah.
Yeah, it's also just so weird because even Martin Sheen, who, famously goes on to star in maybe the prominent war is hell film made in America, Apocalypse Now. It's just so weird to see everybody so young. Even Bob Newhart's young. I
Yeah.
didn't think that could happen.
Hell, and Bob Balaban shows up young. I mean, Christ Almighty, he's always been old and with glasses as long as I can remember. So to see him here, as Orr was shocking as hell, to say the least. But so, I mean, it's not like this is a film that's lacking for clout and talent, but yeah, when it hits theaters, as you're quite right, I mean, it's not really a box office success, because keep in mind, folks, 1970, there is no home video market yet. There is no rental shops or video sell-through to make up lost revenue on
Yeah,
a
they
film.
sort of live and die at the box.
Exactly. And then, I mean, on top of which, yeah, the critical reception, which was not helped by the fact that, yes, 1970 was also the same year Robert Altman brought out his own, people trying to survive war through absurdity film, MASH, itself adapted from a not exactly stellarly reviewed novel, but arguably, hit the zeitgeist in a way that was probably more targeted to the times, both in terms of its general attitude. Because, I mean, it's weird to think of, but 1960s America really does encompass a radical shift from where we are at the start of the 1960s to where they are by the end of the 1960s and at the start of the 1970s, there. And you can really tell, I mean, just look at the Beatles and where they were and how they dressed at the start of the 60s by the time they broke up in the late 60s.
Well, yeah. And I mean, also, I think there is something to be said that, the novel comes out in 1961, and I mean, there's certainly early activity in terms of what would become the Vietnam War, in the early 1960s. By the time this film comes out, though, America can no longer pretend that they are not involved in the Vietnam War and that there's war going on. And I think that in itself may also be kind of, not to say that explains the film's poor reception, but I mean, what I remember somebody's takeaway from MASH and why it works as well as it does is that it's a film about the Korean War, but it's really about Vietnam, and certainly Apocalypse Now and later Platoon and Full Metal Jacket, previous film we've looked at, those are explicitly so. Whereas Catch-22, about World War II, and seems to largely confine itself to being about World War II. And you almost get that sense that a 1970s sophisticated film audience would almost think that's too narrow.
Well, there's part of it there. I'm going to throw out something here, and I'll see what you think about this. I could be wrong here, but let's also take a look at the cast and crew of both of these respective films. The thing about Mike Nichols here is that, is, you know, sort of counterculture is The Graduate is generally held to be. How many people really conceptualize Mike Nichols as a counterculture figure? Because, I mean, when you look at the career he's had, I mean, yes, he deals with sort of radical subject matter from time to time, but he is very much, there's a reason he's sort of considered amongst the sort of like the Hollywood A-list. He's part of that sort of in crowd in a way. And likewise, Alan Arkin, mainstream success. John Voight, mainstream success. Richard Benjamin, his career would go on to be the very definition of mainstream success. Most of these people would go on, you know, to be on sitcoms later on in their career. Meanwhile, you know, MASH, you've got Robert Altman, who thumbed his nose at Hollywood as often, especially when they let him in the doors, oftentimes. You've got, you know, Donald Sutherland, who was basically, I don't know, even know whether Hollywood really knew what to do with him for most of the 1970s there. And then you've got, you know, a cast that filled out with people like Tom Skerritt or, oh, why am I blanking on his name?
Elliot Gould.
Thank you, Elliot Gould there. Like, even just the
friends don't let friends forget about Elliot Gould.
Indeed. Like, there is something that's just like, there's something a little hipper in many ways. I mean, as it is, which is probably why some of those films date a bit more than, say, Catch-22 does. I think unquestionably in its more sort of classical construction and less, you know, overtly mired in the politics of Vietnam itself in this instance. But there,
and I think you may be onto something there, because this isn't a film that so much expresses a counterculture as much as, like, if there's an attitude that the film expresses, it's sort of a general smartassness.
Yeah.
Where it's realizing that the situation's crazy, just sort of rolling your eyes at it while complying, as opposed to outright rejection or refusal.
Well, yeah, and I mean, and that's the kind of the key thing. Whereas, you know, MASH is made up of a film about basically characters whose idea is, well, if we all go a little mad, we can maybe survive the situation. Only to basically, the minute they can go home is dropped in front of them, they just sort of almost seem to snap back into place. Like, all of a sudden, morality kicks back in. Some sense of normalcy kicks back in. You know, this is normal in the world of Catch-22. And that's kind of a
big
problem.
Well, also, Catch-22, the biggest dilemma and one of the central plot points is the impossibility of going home.
Yeah.
And I guess maybe that takes us into the film itself. Yeah. Now, granted, I watched it a few weeks ago. It is a nonlinear narrative in a strict sense. So I think, as we discussed, it's probably better to keep to the general thrust of the story.
Yeah.
But basically, when we're first introduced to our ensemble, it's a group of airmen in the Mediterranean during World War II. And the biggest problem that they're facing is under Colonel Cathcart, played by Martin Balsam, who is very much playing more caricature than character.
Yeah.
But he is quite good.
Oh, yeah.
In the role. His whole thing is that he just, if there's one thing he wants, it's photos of his squadron in the Sunday Evening Post. And so he is constantly moving the goalpost. So originally, they're told that all men there have to fly, I think it's 25 missions before they can go on rotation, go back home. And that number keeps increasing. And I think by the end of the film, it ends up being 80 missions must be flown before anybody can go back home. And that's sort of what brings us to the first big conversation where we sort of go around the table and meet everybody. So, and I mean, I think it's a good sequence because it establishes the vibe and tone of the film pretty quickly. But yeah, we see mostly it's young Alan Arkin as a Yossarian who's in the mess hall, more or less screaming at his colleagues to listen to him, pointing out that, well, he's not going to do that because you'd have to be insane to fly. And so he works out this plan to get his buddy Doc Danica to ground him. You get some sharp dialogue, maybe some of it is a little too canned, where it's like, Dodd, played by Martin Sheen, gives the, imagine for a second, Yossarian, everyone in the world thought the way that you do. And Yossarian says, well, then I'd be a fool to think any different. But his whole point, though, is that it's only a matter of time before he's going to die if he goes up in the air. And again, a very rational way of looking at the situation. And then we get young John Voight as Milo, who plays a bigger role later, pointing out that nobody's trying to kill you. And then we get the great quip, then why are they all shooting at me, Milo?
Yes.
But it's interesting because there is it's an interesting, like, almost domestic scene where the guys are clearly all a bit different from one another, and Yossarian more different than all of them, but there's this understanding and this sort of camaraderie regardless. It's almost like we don't get scenes of back home, so this is the closest thing we have to a kitchen table family dinner that the film provides.
Well, absolutely. Now, the thing to also keep in mind here is that when the film opens, the first thing, our very first scene is sort of like at dawn. And all it is we don't get any music. It's just we're seeing the sun rising, we're seeing sort of the airstrip, we're hearing the engines of the planes starting to roll, and we see at a distance Yossarian in a conversation with Cathcart, and
Oh,
Horn
yeah.
there.
Now I'm remembering that actually pretty incredible opening.
Yeah, and the reason it's significant is we don't hear what they're saying because all we can hear is the roar of the engines. And it's almost got this dreamlike quality with Yossarian, making his way down. We don't know what his conversation's been. We don't know what it's about. But we see as soon as he hits the ground, a soldier who seems to be doing some sweeping up. We don't see their face. They turn around. They straight up, knife Yossarian in the back and leave him for dead. And takes off. So while the Yossarian is just sort of bleeding out on the tarmac here, we get our first flashback here as he's talking about Snowden and other things, and just sort of going into this fade to white.
Yeah, which is a recurring device that Nichols uses throughout the film. And honestly, it is a really good effect, especially because it's not a straight cut, it's not a dissolve, it's moving on to a white part of the frame, and then by the time it pans over, we're at a different point in time.
Yeah.
And it takes a while to sort of put events into order. Like, we discover that really, the opening scene is the end of the film, and then we jump to what happens before the events of the film really even begin. But yeah, we see a very basically Yossarian in shock trying to communicate on the radio after his plane has been shot down and asking him to check on the gunner. But we also get, like, sort of the latent black humor though of the whole check on the bomber. I am the bomber. Then check on the gunner.
Yeah, well, exactly. There's also the fact that as we'll keep coming back to the scene, and each time it plays out, we see a little bit more. Things play out a little bit differently as we sort of get closer and closer to what exactly went down on that day. The other thing that's sort of interesting quality of it, though, is that it gives the sort of structure of the film. We get the sense that we're almost seeing the memories of a dead man, and it almost takes on this hallucinogenic quality where we're flowing from one event to the other to another, including the things that Yossarian could not reasonably have been around for, which allows for certain unique visual gags and ideas and things that don't necessarily quite add up, but are interesting, with probably the biggest one being a scene involving Bob Newhart's major, and a picture on his wall.
Oh, yes.
That we'll get to in a bit. But yeah, I mean, with this, yeah, we're really have the sort of general thrust of the film set up, which is, yes, Yossarian wants out, he can't get out. And it's really sort of a series of vignettes as we sort of see different little sub-stories and sub-ideas playing out. So, particularly with the other members of the group. So let's, maybe the easy...
And I think vignettes is actually the best way to think about this film. Because, I mean, if Heller and if Nichols and Henry wanted to tell, this is the story of Yossarian beginning to end, they could have easily done so. And the problem is, I think, especially watching it this time around, it's harder to get a sense of flow to the film, especially because some of the jumps don't seem so organically prompted. Like, I agree with you that the opening really does give it this sort of surreal, almost dreamlike associative structure. You know, the enlisted man's JoJo dancer. But the problem is, I don't feel like it deploys that framing consistently. So you end up having some really interesting transitions or jumps, and then you have a lot that really just sort of proceed on rails as well.
There are moments, and I won't fully disagree with you. I think while watching it, the structure didn't necessarily bother me. It's realizing that there are certain characters and subplots that get a more fleshed out fleshed out on film itself, versus what we see in other components of the film. And particularly when we get to the end, the absence of the development of one or two characters sort of stifles the impact in one or two points there. So maybe the easiest way to go around is maybe we should just go character by character around Yossarian and sort of cover their sort of interactions with him in this instance. And probably the key one in this instance is Nately, played by Art Garfunkel here, who's sort of the young, you know, air pilot here who seems to have quote unquote found love with a local woman in the area, whose character, who's played by Gina Rovere, hopefully I'm not mispronouncing her name, but she's credited as, and this is actually the credit in the film, folks, this is not my description here, Nately's whore.
Yeah.
Which, and yeah,
it also dates the film in some ways. And it's also impossible to argue that this is not an incredibly male-driven film. Yeah. And I mean, you couldn't exactly come up with a plausible reason to have an all-female air squadron on the other side of the base that they were having volleyball games against or whatever. But I mean, also some of the humor and, you know, I don't think it traverses the line to outright misogyny, but this is very much a movie by men, about men, for men.
Yeah, I mean, I may be willing to go and say that there is a strongly misogynistic streak to this film, as in MASH. Let me be clear. Both films, if you watch them, the misogyny is on full display here, folks. But I...
Well, it also gets us into the dilemma of, well, you're trying to tell a story about guys who are so desperate for the very idea of a woman that they see them and turn into animals versus, you know, you're still the ones making and filming and producing this story, right? But Nately is kind of like, almost like the rational consciousness or conscience to Yossarian. He's one of the good ones. You know, he's sweet. He believes he's doing the right thing by being an airman. But at the end of the day, like, he has no dreams of being a hero or a decorated soldier or anything. He wants to do his service and come home. But at the same time, there is an extended sequence in, I guess it's a brothel, where he has that long debate with the old man, played by Marcel Dalio, who himself was a French actor who fled to America during wartime. And they have this long, almost Marx Brothers-esque dialogue about the futility or necessity of warfare and whether or not America fighting a war overseas could be construed as doing the right thing. But the takeaway of that is the old man is saying that, well, even if you think America is righteous and you may think you're fighting a good cause, you've already lost. And then Nate Lee points out, but the Italians have already surrendered. We haven't. We're going to win this war. And he says, well, that's where you're wrong, though, because Italy has surrendered, whereas the Americans continue to fight. And that's why Italy has won the war.
And again, coming back to that sort of circular logic, there is really one of the more complex elements of this film that's worth dealing with there. And certainly, when it comes to Nate Lee, I mean, he really is, you're quite right. I mean, his story ultimately is the one that's going to end in tragedy by the end of the film because, yes, Despois, he will ultimately be the one who dies before this film's over with, which arguably you could say is engaging in the old trope. Of course, the innocent one dies in this instance. But again, it's well played. And again, as much as or I've made fun of Art Garfunkel in this exact episode here, his performance as Nate Lee is really good throughout this
Yeah,
film.
he's more than adequate. Like, he certainly doesn't bring it down. He doesn't have much to do other than be kind of idealistic about America's role in overseas combat, but he's likable enough. It seems more entertaining than the concert for Central Park. Because honestly, I mean, I know that they got like 200,000 people to come there, but I turned on the TV one day and there's Art Garfunkel wearing like a leather vest, just sort of swaying, like, "Bridge over troubled water." And I'm like, you cannot tell me this many people came out to see this.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, Nate Lee is sort of the good one. We'll hold off on the consequences of his death and where things go from there, because that's going to be important later on. But maybe we should then turn to Milo, Minder
Yes.
Binder,
Because
who.
Milo, small role, but an important one, played by John Voight. Milo, and the book goes more into exactly how he arrives at this idea, but Milo's whole thing, he works in the mess hall, but he also has figured it all out. And the best way, the best opportunity that the war is presented, is that they can form a syndicate.
Let it be known, kids.
And early on, he explains to Major Cathcart by showing him a fresh egg in the middle of the Mediterranean. And then he starts explaining how he is able to sell some of the mess supplies to local traders, which gets them excess supplies, which they can then turn around and sell on secondary markets. And as he's explaining, well, it's not stealing from the mess hall, because if we form a syndicate, then anytime we take supplies, the mess hall gets shares in the syndicate. And then once the war is over, we're all going to be rich. And again, it's especially in the post-Bernie Madoff era, it's easy to take for granted kind of the absurdist logic or sort of what happens in his arc, but it eventually gets to the point where it more or less becomes an enormous pyramid scheme, and eventually the enlisted men find themselves without supplies or opening their parachute bags and finding shares in the syndicate. But it does lead to some rather humorous moments, such as Milo getting absolutely swindled on Egyptian cotton, and he tries to convince Yossarian to test his new product, which is chocolate-covered cotton. And which one of the funniest parts of the movie is his absolute indignation as he proclaims, "People eat cotton candy. Surely they'll appreciate the real thing."
Exactly.
But and that arc culminates with Milo eventually. In order to avoid taking a real bath on a deal, he works out a deal with the Germans that if they blow up part of their own air force base, the German side will buy some supplies off of them, and thus the syndicate can remain solvent.
Yeah, and that twist in it becomes one of the darkest aspects of this film.
Well, yeah, and because it begins as such, like, very much like that kind of Marx Brothers absurdity where simple concepts stretch to its logical breaking point, and by the time the punchline comes, it really is one of the darkest moments of the film.
And the thing is, it eventually gets us into some very surreal imagery in the aftermath, as well as once Yossarian starts trying to find Nate Lee's love in this instance. I won't use the actual
courtesan.
Yeah. He goes searching through, and what he ends up discovering is that Milo has basically commodified or taking control of the prostitution rings of Italy, it seems, in this case. And like the to the point where, yeah, the men are now coming through his organization in order to find women. It is just the imagery of it is just, to give Nichols full credit, it is stark and disturbing. And it very much brings almost that, funny enough to bring up Orson Welles for a second, and not in the context of this particular film. Have you ever seen his film The Trial with Anthony Perkins?
No, I have not. I actually started reading The Trial because I found a website that I won't name, but it allows you to access a whole lot of classic literature for free. Hit me up on Twitter!
I'm pretty sure The Trial is in the public domain, but so you're probably okay. But the way, there's a lot of imagery in that sequence in particular. It feels like Nichols was taking a look at what this sort of surreal imagery that Welles was doing in that film, and a lot of his sort of late European in Spain period films as well.
Yeah, and there is something undeniably Kafka-esque about a lot of, certainly with a lot of what Heller's doing in his text as well. So, I mean, it's a plausible reference point, right? Plus, I mean, this is a film that has Orson Welles and Tony Perkins.
Exactly. Oh, yeah, that's right. Perkins is in this film as well.
Who we should probably talk about here, because honestly, like, one of the criticisms of this film is that the film gives us a wide array of characters, and Yossarian is clearly our protagonist, but there's not much of an attempt to explore the interiority or the psychology of the characters, sort of what makes them, what motivates them. Milo is an easy arc to follow, where he just genuinely believes in market economics, and next thing you know, he becomes a grinning war profiteer. I would say he doesn't really get an arc, but Anthony Perkins, in his role as Chaplain Tapman, is maybe the most human character in the entire film.
Because he is somebody who's trying desperately to remain humane and warm and welcoming and supportive in a situation that is so very easily for people to get fallen into to despair. And
because he first meets Yossarian when Yossarian's in the infirmary, and there's the running joke though about how everyone keeps calling him father or padre, to which he always like meekly tries, actually I'm a chaplain, I'm Anabaptist.
Exactly.
And like we talked about in our Psycho episode, that sort of why Hitchcock's film works in ways that Van Sant's film doesn't is that in Van Sant, there's never a moment where we don't know who Norman Bates is. Whereas when he's played by Anthony Perkins, you know, it's really easy to forget just how personable and sweet Anthony Perkins is as a performer.
Yeah.
And that is fully on display here. And it doesn't carry through into the film, but one of the funniest lines in the book is when they first meet, and it's, you know, who are you? I'm Chaplain Tapman, said Chaplain Tapman. Oh, you're a chaplain? Said Yossarian. Yes. Didn't you know I was a chaplain? Said Chaplain Tapman. No, I didn't know you were a chaplain.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's up there with, I'm not Count Olaf, said Count Olaf. But that being said, like, Perkins, just his sweetness is such an amusing counterpoint, especially when, he tells Yossarian that, well, I'm the chaplain here. I can't have you grounded. I can't override orders or anything. And chaplains and Yossarian starts freaking out at bedside. And then after a long silence, it's like, well, maybe I can do some other things for you. Cigarettes, toys.
Exactly. He's just like, he has no, like, he so badly wants to connect and do well, and just it's not his fault that he can't.
Exactly.
So.
But then he is also ordered by Cathcart, though, that because the other regiments, they got their pictures in the post by having the chaplain there give a big inspiring speech right before the mission and that. And he's constantly getting put upon. And that's when we get pretty much one of the only scenes, but very much a show-stealing scene between comedy legends Norman Fell and Bob Newhart, who, again, it's one of those things that you sort of roll your eyes at now, but he plays Major, 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 who he's basically the custodian, but one of the majors ends up getting killed in action, and so they need to find a replacement. He advises Cathcart that he's not a ranked man, his last name is Major, and so are his first and middle names, to which Cathcart says that's good enough. And then we get the extended scene of Major telling his man at arms, trying to look up his name. There's too many people in this cast. What's Norman Fell's guy? Towser, who's his attendant, basically having, that very Samuel Beckett kind of scene with him climbing out the window and explaining that he's only to be seen when he's not here. If he is in his office, he is not to be disturbed. So if anyone wants to see him, they have to wait for him to leave.
Yeah, and it's a brilliantly structured scene because it mostly plays out in long takes and throughout there as the camera is sort of following Bob Newhart as he's going on his sort of ranting and raving. But one of the interesting details of the scene is as he keeps walking away from his desk, and when you're looking at his desk the first time, behind him is a photo of is it Roosevelt, I think, the first time? Or no. Or is it Teddy? Not Teddy. Franklin.
Franklin.
Yeah, there. And he
Yes.
wanders away. And when he comes back, it's no longer Franklin. I believe it's Churchill is who it then goes to next. He then wanders away again. And when he comes back, suddenly it's Hitler that's up on the wall. And he wanders away again. He comes back and it's Stalin the last time. And it's the sort of thing where. You know, this kind, it's the kind of gag that would in other films break the diegesis or indicate that we are in very much like a Zucker Abrams, Zucker style film where, crazy stuff can and will happen. That's not quite what's going on because it's not like the scene draws your attention to the
Yeah,
gag.
it's very subtle to the point where you could very easily miss that. And I mean, getting back to sort of what this film is trying to do and whether or not it's even supposed to be like a modern commentary or anything like that, that sort of does open up a space where this film can be a lot more subversive than it ultimately ends up becoming. So it feels weird that they chose not to do things like that more often.
It is, and I mean, it's very interesting because I would honestly love to know what led to the choice because that could have been in the script, but it could also just have been something on the day that they cooked up, and I would love to know what the inspiration behind it was.
Well, yeah, but I mean, and I mean, I guess if we're talking about Major, Major, though, I guess maybe the big performance of the film, and a very limited one though, is the one and only Orson Welles as General Dreedle,
Yes.
who I've seen a lot of criticism that, oh, Welles by this point is clearly phoning it in. I think he works just fine here because at this point we have full-size Orson Welles. this larger-than-life figure and commanding respect from everyone around him, which, again, an interesting sort of meta-text reference to Orson Welles and his role within American film. But, like, he doesn't have a lot to do other than sit there and look commanding while everybody else just goes crazy over his wife. But, but I don't know, there is something very amusing about just watching him scowl and pin medals to everybody, and then Yossarian comes up without his uniform or any clothes, and then finally agreeing to just hand him his medal, and then give one of those moments that you feel like they thought this was going to be the quote that everybody went and ran with, which is, "You're a very weird person, Yossarian. Thank you."
Yeah, and the thing is, I really love Wells' performance here, partly because when we see his character, the thing we quickly realize is that he is just as dumbfounded by everything that's going on as everybody else. In terms of, like, it's this sort of condemning of the military leadership, because you've got, you know, Major, who's sort of, you know, rejecting, you know, just any sense of authority. It's like, no, I'm not here. I'm not responsible. I've got nothing. You've got Cathcart, who is a glory hound, the entire way through. And then, yeah, you've got, Wells here doing, just looking, up his character's name here, cause I completely, Dreedle, who, I mean, he's a fearful presence, but he is no more clued into the realities of war as well. And in fact, he almost seems to, like, there's this running gag about the fact that he just wants to execute his own men for any reason, it seems. And it's constantly having to be pointed out to him that, no, you can't do that in this instance. You have to, you know, there are reasons you can terminate or execute people. Most of what you're asking for cannot happen.
Well, yeah, and then he basically just gets to the point where it's fine, whatever, let's just get this over with. And I mean, though, that's also something maybe we can talk about when we finally untangle how we're even gonna finish talking about this movie. But I guess I feel like, especially in 2021, given especially the events over the last month, it is very easy to take for granted, sort of, I guess, having a film that feels like its biggest statement is just, well, the generals have no idea what they're doing, and they're all just as myopic and blind as anybody else. I feel like that has a very different resonance to audiences in 1970, whereas by the time you watch it in 2021, I mean, that's a fairly well-worn sentiment.
It is. What I would say, though, and I think this is maybe the key thing for me, is that one of the things that's very noticeable about almost all the leadership in this film is that these are generally older men, with the possible exception of Bob Newhart, who even in younger form still looks like he's, you know, been around for about 40 years by that point in time. He just can't help it. I think, the figure of Milo, though, is the one to really keep an eye on here, because really, when you're looking at that, he may not be a leader now. He is very clearly the kind of guy who's going to be gunning for leadership in the future, whether it's political leadership, whether it's military leadership, or more likely, corporate leadership in America. And
he's enterprising, right?
Yeah.
And that's what makes him, in many respects, the real villain of the film.
Well, and this also brings us, I think, to the area where the film misses, I don't want to say it misses a step, but I mean, where things are a little underdeveloped, and this is kind of the key character we have to talk about, and that is Arfi Aardvark, here played by Charles Grodin. And there's a number of reasons why he is a significant figure to go into, but you, watching the film, you would never know it for the first two-thirds of the movie.
Because he's not in it all that much. And again, the book develops him a little bit further, as I recall as well. But yeah, because he's mostly there in the first big set piece, which is the bombing run, which in itself is a really well shot and well constructed scene. And I mean, it captures like the chaos of combat very well, but he's the navigator and always smokes his pipe.
Yeah, and he almost has this sort of devil may care, enjoy, sort of laugh at life approach to things that we see. He's honestly fairly affable, would might be the way to sort of describe him through the other things. It's not that he's anybody's friend, but he always seems to be that weirdly charming guy that everybody almost seems to center around there, but you never spend a lot of time with him. And the reason he's significant is because, you know, he has that affability. He has that sort of nothing's impacting him. Nothing, you know, he's not taking it all that seriously there. You know, he's got the probably the most level head to get through this, at least on the surface. When we get to the end of the film, however, after Nately's died and Yossarian is sort of wandering the streets, has finally informed Nately's love that he's dead, and she basically blames Yossarian and condemns him for bringing this news to him, that he's having to sort of escape from her so he's not killed. He's wandering the streets in the middle of basic, I believe it's an air raid that's going on around this, or at least there's something military activity going on. Looking out, looking around, trying to find, just wandering the streets, when all of a sudden a woman's
Well, he's
body.
looking for his own paramour, who I don't
Yeah.
think is ever named, the Italian girl that he's sweet on. And I mean, again, it's not really developed if he has family or a life back home. He has the girl that he sees whenever he is on leave, and they do have some cute scenes together. Again, nothing. The problem is it can only be so meaningful when it's so underdeveloped. But it does come as a pretty big shock when Yossarian finds her body dead on the pavement after being thrown out of a window.
And he wander runs up there, and I'm not even sure that it's her body. It's a what? That's the thing. It's like they never even clearly established, because he runs upstairs, and what he
I think
finds.
it's supposed to be her.
See, I don't, because he never mentions it. I don't think he never calls her by name. He never says who it is. He's just asked us like why
But
when he
then
gets.
what happens to the woman then?
Well, the point of the matter is that he ultimately he runs upstairs to figure out who what happened to her, who did this, and who he ends up finding there is Aardvark. They're cowering in the corner, basically admitting that he, you know, that yeah, he killed her, and rationalizing it away, and basically admitting that he is a rapist, he is a killer, he has done these things, and you know,
Well,
we
it's even
see.
worse than that because he calls back to the earlier line when they're teasing him about his lack of interest in women, and because he says at the time, "Oh, you know, Arfie, I'm not the type to pay for it," and he
Yeah.
uses that line again very coldly to Yossarian. The MPs kick in the door, and then they arrest Yossarian because he is off base without leave.
Yeah, and probably the most cruel punchline of the whole film, unquestionably at that point, where the, you know, just literally the murderer is right there. He has committed this crime. He's admitted to the crime. And nothing happens to him. Like, there is no, we never get any closure in any sense that anything's happened to him at all. And
But
for
it
all
also
we
makes
know, this.
perfect sense in the logic of the film because
Oh,
it
yeah.
doesn't matter whether people live or die. What matters is that procedure and protocol and all the rules are followed.
Well, absolutely. And I think that's probably why it's such a, you know, a fright. Like, even Milo, with his dark a turn as his stuff takes. You can kind of still find a glimmer of humor in it. This you cannot. And I think that's the thing. Whereas Milo, yeah, will probably be the larger threat in the grand scheme of things upon the return to America. We probably have a future serial killer, you know, waiting to return on the shores. And everybody's basically okay with that. And
Yeah.
that
But I mean,
is.
like, this is near the end of the film, though, and I mean, the confusion over who the victim actually is kind of speaks to a larger point, though, because, like, the character of Dodd, played by Martin Sheen, more or less vanishes from the film. Doc Danica, who tells us about the Catch-22, like, more or less disappears midway through the film as well, after, and again, you get a. Probably an overlong scene of one pilot, more or less snapping and flying into a mountain, but to get his flight hours, Dr. Nika had him write his name on the passenger roll,
Yeah.
And so everybody's looking at the plane, telling, cheering for Doc to parachute out without realizing that he's standing right next to him.
Yeah.
And then he ends up being declared legally dead, despite the fact that he is still alive. It's sort of like Inglourious Basterds, where it's a big cast, but if you actually try and track who dies and when and what happens to everybody, it doesn't actually add up.
Well, I mean, it's hard. I would say that it adds up in the while you're watching it. It's just none of it in terms of the problem with the cast is big is that it's hard to remember who what survives and why in this film, because more or less most of the support network or people, either friends or associates of Yossarian, are pretty much almost all gone by the end, save for two. And this sort of brings us to the end of the film, because...
we should also talk about Orr, played by Bob Balaban,
who, oh, yes.
Again, small but important performance, because all we really learn about Orr is that nobody wants to fly with him because he keeps crashing his airplanes into the ocean.
Yeah.
And eventually his plane is shot down over the Mediterranean. Everybody assumes that he's dead. And that's kind of like the first of the gang to go. And I mean, I would agree with you, Dave, where if the film has a structure, it's the gradual whittling away of that sort of tight unit at the beginning of the film. And, you know, people showing their true colors, people getting killed, and people just falling off the map. So all of it adds up where Yossarian is basically alone.
Exactly. So basically what ends up happening is, through a series of events basically involving this whole airbase snafu with the bombing run on it and other situations, Yossarian basically he's given a proposition. He will be allowed to go home, according to Cathcart, as long as he praises Cathcart's leadership and all the good work they're doing and sing his praises at home. And despite the fact that Yossarian clearly does not like him at all, he is not willing to turn this down. And this is, in fact, the conversation he was having right at the start of the film, was him agreeing to,
yes,
yeah, I'll do it. I'll, basically play you up as a hero and effectively just sell everybody else under the bus, despite all the things I know you've done here, so I can go home. Of course, he gets stabbed.
Well, it's not just that, Dave, because remember when Cathcart makes the offer with Colonel Korn, who doesn't do much, played by Buck Henry, the screenwriter of the film, who's basically like the devil on his shoulder the entire time.
Yeah.
But they lay out the offer. Yossarian says, what do I have to do? And it's not just say good things about it. The first thing they say, do you remember?
Yes, like us.
Like us. And again, it's the difference between, understanding that in 1984, Big Brother seeks to control you. But when you read it and you think about it more, it's like, no, the important thing is that Big Brother commands that you love him. And it's the idea that that's one of those moments that, you know, like the changing portrait, signals to a bigger point being made there. It's not just say good things about Colonel Cathcart, but Yossarian, we are your superior officers. We want you to like us. You know, sort of the idea that it's not just that you're going to lie and say good things for us, but that we want you to embrace the system we are a part of.
Yeah, exactly. And for his troubles, Yossarian goes down the stairs having agreed to this, and it turns out that Natalie's lover basically is in that uniform and jabs him in the back, leading us to ultimately refining out what happened to Snowden in full, which is, that basically when Yossarian went to help him, he pulls back the wounds, and Snowden's entire contents of his stomach just pour out of him in probably the goriest image of the entire film there.
And there's a very dark brick joke as well, because trying to comfort Snowden, who's clearly about to die, Yossarian says he'll get him some morphine, opens the medical supply kit, and it's full of shares in the syndicate.
Yeah, exactly. And you might think, some films this would be the point where we cut back and we find that Yossarian's dead, but that's not actually what's happened here. Because he wakes up in the infirmary and there are two people there to check up on him. One is Major Danby, played by Richard Benjamin, who we haven't really talked about much because, you know, he's a constant presence throughout the film. And I like Richard Benjamin's portrayal. It's like he's the most normal of the pilots in there, but he's also the one who knows how to
play. He has a very can-do attitude. Like, he's the one who gives everyone their orders and is like, all right, everybody, we're gonna fly on out there. It's gonna be a great mission.
Yeah.
And everybody just begrudgingly goes off to their deaths. He's almost impossibly cheerful for the circumstances.
Yeah, but he's not, the way the film sells him, he's not outright villainous or inept in quite the same way that the others are of the authority figures. Like, you get the sense that he's just this, he's that middle management type where he's really closely associated with the guys, but he has to tiptoe around his bosses as well, and he knows how to play that field. But he's also there with, in this case,
Chaplain Chapman.
Yeah, who are there to check up on Yossarian, and they basically have this whole conversation with him where Yossarian's basically admitting, like, this is what's going to go down, and we hear the marching band that's being prepared for this whole, you know, charade that Yossarian's going to be participating in playing outside. And he's explaining the whole thing about what he's going to do in all this and starts listing off all the people that they've lost, including Orr. And that's when a little detail drops, doesn't it, Andrew?
Yeah, because it turns out, like, Danby and Chaplain Tabman have a chuckle and do the, oh, you didn't hear? Because it turns out that Orr was shot down, but he didn't die. In fact, he ended up escaping and basically was taken in for medical treatment in Switzerland?
Yeah, somewhere like that, but he's basically...
basically neutral territory where he is now laid up in a hospital surrounded by gorgeous women, and he found a way to get out of the war and get out of the system. And with that, Yossarian realizes that the same thing can happen with him. So instead of embracing the parade, he more or less jumps out the window, runs along the beach, and we get... the film sees us out with Danby and Tapman more or less like asking him if he's sure about what he's doing. Yossarian... ardently pointing out that yes, this is what he's going to do, because it sounds crazy, but it is possible, as he grabs an inflatable raft while the band is playing the the da 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 da, and I feel like it's deliberately overmixed on the soundtrack. It's a bombardment when it kicks in. But Yossarian ends up running out to sea, inflating the raft. And he hops in and starts paddling. And that's basically the end of the film. But of course, in true Mike Nichols fashion, we don't end on the one shot. We hold the shot as it zooms ever outward, showing just how small Yossarian is against the backdrop of the ocean. And as impossible as it seems, though, he is going to try to make it his own way.
Well, and on top of that, the way it's also staged, what's interesting is once Yossarian jumps out the window, we see him running and running and running. And the way we described it, you might sit there picturing Danby and the chaplain, like, yelling at him, getting to, but they're not. They're actually speaking at, like, a quiet voice without moving, without following him, nothing. And Yossarian is responding in this quiet voice, which, realistically, they could never hear, and he shouldn't really be able to hear them. Here, so we almost end up in this, you know, it's clearly almost delusional land, or this very amorphous landscape where is what we're seeing here even real, as it were? Is this just this sort of deranged hope that he's...
Is it a flight of fantasy, right?
Yeah, and it's not like, and again, it's not a case of this is, you know, I'm trying to say in the ending of the film didn't happen. It clearly is, you know, appearing before us and is still the end of the film. But ultimately, how you choose to interpret it, there are several ways But it's kind of hard not to come away with at least a little bit of downbeat cynicism somewhere in the mix at some point.
Yeah, because you can read it optimistically and literally. You can read this as a break from reality. You can read this as really happening, but holding on to that final shot, indicating the impossibility of the task. And the problem is, it's like, I guess it's the difference between an open text versus an unfocused one. And I guess watching it this time around really struck me that it doesn't quite feel like a satisfying payoff. And maybe that's just the way that wartime narratives have evolved in the years since this film came out. And the fact that we can't put ourselves 51 years ago and imagine what it would be like seeing this in theater. It's just, it does feel strange though, where the film seems to be pretty unsubtle in its messaging or its presentation of like the military bureaucracy and the absurd logic at the heart of it. And it does feel like there are moments of rupture where, you know, for instance, with Arfie or the Snowden payoff to that, where all of a sudden it just becomes very real in a way that kind of ruptures a lot of the film's tone. And indeed, that's kind of where a lot of the criticism of the film lies, where there are these jumps in tone, but especially thinking about the ending and sort of the formal break there, because also I would like to point out that the whole conversation between the three men is also a long take, as the camera like navigates through incredibly high ceilings. And it does feel very stage-esque in how that scene is laid out. And I really like watching it, even though it's kind of unremarkable. The problem is, it's like, this film doesn't quite know when it wants to be straightforward and when it wants to be a flight of fancy. It doesn't quite know when it wants to be very literal in its messaging versus being more allegorical. And as a result, I feel like it's difficult for the audience to get a sense of that either. And not to say that, you know, it was a mistake to make this film, or even that this is a bad film or anything, but watching it this time, really, it kind of stood out that I don't know if Nichols and Henry ultimately decided what they wanted this film to be. And so it feels a lot less unified as a film than I think you would expect, given the fact that the tone is pretty consistent for most of it.
See, and the funny thing is I actually probably responded to the film much better this time, because I watched it once previously, and it kind of landed with a thud on me at the time. Now, granted, I was in late high school at the point. I don't think I was at quite the point to really pick up on a lot of it at that time, but this time I found it much more pleasant and much more enjoyable. May not be the right word, because I don't know if this is a film that's necessarily meant to be enjoyed per se, given what it's talking about, what it's addressing, but it's certainly, I found it more impactful overall. And I found I was much more willing to go with the loose vignette style of the film overall. I think it really is just some of that connective tissue that bothers me more than anything else, where Arfie, like, I wish there was more time spent with him and developing him, so, you know, it didn't just seem, it's like, and suddenly Charles Grodin is the killer, you know, at this end, because you could very easily forget that he's in this movie by the time he pops back up again there. And that's the sort of
the other problem is, like, the vignette structure sort of keeps like a clear narrative from emerging. Like, there's the problem is though that especially the way that the flashbacks to Snowden are deployed is that, I don't know, like, it almost feels in some ways like that reveal happens to almost be like, oh, so that's why Yossarian is trying to get out, or that's why he's going a little squirrely. But then you sort of run the risk of being like, so if Yossarian hadn't have seen Snowden die, then he would just be a fine military man. Like, I don't know. The problem is that it's, I feel like This is a film that's more about presenting a world and an array of characters than it is with necessarily giving us a clear narrative.
Well, and I will put to you this way. They actually, a couple of years ago, there was a remake done of this. Not as a feature film, but as a television series from George Clooney.
Which I have not seen, and I hear is terrible.
See, and that was the question, because I have not seen it. The fact that nobody, that I'd even forgotten that it had, you know, it had been already been released, was pretty much, it's like, oh, yeah, this came out and nobody's really talking about it. That's probably a bad sign. But it does strike me is, you know, television might not necessarily be the worst place for it. But I honestly don't know if there's much of a point at this time returning to the source material to take a third swing at it, because I don't think there's much left to be mined for contemporary viewers and audiences in this instance. And that's kind of a problem that I don't know. I mean, again, it speaks to the fact that, you know, George Clooney, a man of a certain age and of a certain generation, was the person sort of pushing in the drive to get that made in many ways. So,
well, yeah. And again, going back to Mike Nichols and The Graduate, like, he does have some films that really capture the zeitgeist or really sort of speak to an era. And if you grow up in that era, like, I don't want to be as dismissive as to be like, well, if you're a baby boomer, you love Catch 22, and if you're not, you don't care. But I think there is something that very much has to be factored in, because it's an important book for a certain generation of, you know, primarily American culture. And I do feel like that moment has kind of moved on. Or at least the world has moved on to the point where it's harder to look at this text in 2021 and understand why what it was doing at the time of its release is significant.
Well, and I mean, it's not unlike a lot of other similar texts in that regard. Like, look, Hunter S. Thompson, as significant as a figure as he once was, it's really hard for people, I would say now, to really wrap their mind about why Hunter S. Thompson was such a big deal at the time he was around. And again, him and Heller couldn't be any more different from what I've seen of Heller's biography. But I mean, they were both figures who spoke to a particular generation. And I don't think there really is an audience in this day and age for a Thompson figure in this age. Yeah.
And I mean, you could say the same about Hemingway, right? Like, yeah, writing stuff like The Sun Also Rises is very much informed by World War II and sort of trying to find a way to make sense of the world after events like that happen. Or even something like Slaughterhouse-Five and the idea that, you know, once you see Dresden firebombed into nothing, or knowing that atomic weaponry has been deployed, how do you go about just being in the world the way that you used to? And, you know, the problem is that these works end up being so influential and informative on subsequent ones that by the time you go back to the source, it's easy to lose sight of why they spawned so many texts that were influenced by them.
Just keep that in mind, Denis Villeneuve, once Dune comes out. I'm just saying that in advance. But yeah, no, you're absolutely right there. And that's the thing. It's like, I'm not saying that people shouldn't see this movie, not by a long stretch. I think a lot of it is really good. I think Alan Arkin, you know, is damn good in this movie throughout here. And you can really, much more than Inspector Clouseau, he's much more comfortable here than he is in that film, and has really found sort of his voice in this particular movie.
Yeah, and at the time of the release, certainly people who you could tell really loved the book disliked his performance, because they thought that he's playing it a bit too wacky or a bit too crazy, whereas, you know, certain readers are of the mind that, no, it's actually that Yossarian is the only sane one. I think it works really well here. It is a performance that I really enjoy. And I mean, not to lose sight, because I, you know, Roger Ebert, his review, tears the film to pieces and gives it 3 stars anyway. And that's sort of the problem with this film, because it's almost more interesting to speculate why it doesn't work as well as it feels like it should, given the parts that are there and given the potential that this film shows. But then you end up spending most of the discussion about what doesn't work, and you really lose sight of the fact that this is still a very well done film. And in that respect, I'm very happy to once again say that that behooves us to turn to our patent-pending bumper segment, Hits and Pits, where we celebrate and condemn the little things.
Yes.
So given the fact that this film is sort of messily structured and has way more characters than it really knows what to do with, I think this is the segment where Catch-22 can truly shine. So Dave, Mike Nichols, Catch-22, what is your first hit?
There's a particular vignette that we didn't really have room to discuss there that I think is one of the comedic highlights and sadder parts of the film as well, where I believe it's Danaka who ends up asking Yosarian at a certain point. It's like, look, there's this family that's coming. They've come to see their dying son. The son's dead. And I want you to go in there and pretend to be their son. Now, that plan sounds ludicrous for a variety of reasons, as you might assume, but Yosarian goes along with it. And basically, it's this combination of incredibly sad gag where Yosarian's there talking to them, and it's like, yeah, you don't even recognize us here, or they don't even recognize him. And the question of, do they even know who their actual son is? As the scene's playing out, that's really darkly funny here, where it's like, yeah, they're willing to go along with this ruse, which should be obvious, and it's either they're so grief-stricken that they can't tell, or they didn't really know, or they've completely lost sight of who their son was in the first place. But having said that, there's one other reason I want to bring this scene up, Andrew, and that is the brother of the dead pilot. Did you recognize who happened to play him in this instance?
I might have, like, a month ago when I watched this film. Off the top of my head, I cannot say.
A little before a month or so ago, we took a look at a little film called The In-Laws, where Richard Libertini popped up as the not exactly stable general, and here he is also popping up as the brother in this scene.
No blindfolds. We are a very poor country.
Exactly. Not quite as memorable as that, but it is nonetheless. I think one of the scenes that sort of illustrates the sort of bitter, cynical heart at the of this film quite a bit. So for me, that's my first hit.
Yeah, I mean, that is a really good scene, isn't it? But I would say I'm going to give my first hit not to one of the on-screen characters, but one behind the scenes, and that would be to cinematographer David Watkin, who also worked on films like Ken Russell's The Devils and Chariots of Fire. And, I mean, this is a film that has a pretty drab setting in terms of color palette, in terms of everyone in uniform. It does expand a bit when they go on leave and you get scenes of them in Italy. But at the same time, the cinematography is very interesting. There's a lot of what feel like crane shots. There's a lot of interesting long takes. There's a sense of visual dynamism, even if the action in front of the camera is not terribly dynamic. And the scenes of the bombers in flight really are pretty spectacular, especially realizing that they were all done practically. This is a film that ends up looking a lot better than its material sort of dictates. And I guess that makes sense, because Watkin also shot Chariots of Fire. And I mean, you want to make a film about two guys running and make it look interesting? Well, he's the man who found a way. So, it ends up being, I wish this film was a little more formally audacious than it is, but there are those, certainly, shots, and as you were pointing out, Yosarian, right before the confrontation with Arfi, that really does evoke sort of a much more European sensibility and a much more sort of artistic style of filmmaking. And I think in the context of a very American war story told about very American soldiers, it ends up producing some moments of really interesting contrast.
Absolutely. No, I completely, completely agree with you on that one. On a similar note, I'm actually going to give credit also to editor Sam Osteen in this instance. Now, I know we've been a little bit critical about this, but let's consider the job Steen had in front of him here for a second. You have what is effectively a non-linear narrative made up of vignettes, and you had to stitch this together in a way that naturally flows while also keeping an almost dreamlike quality to everything. They cannot be overstated the amount, the heavy lifting he had to have done on this film for it to work even 90% as well as it does here in this instance. Like, this is, I mean, for all of its faults, this could have gone so much worse without a sure hand at the controls there. And Osteen really, I think his work is the one to really pay attention, because the fact that even in the midst of watching it, it still feels structured and like it has some sort of sense of pulse and being propelled forward while you're watching it. I mean, that is not an easy trick to pull off here. So Osteen certainly gets my second hit for this one.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, it's often been said, like, speaking of Dune, David Lynch, how his films make a lot more sense when you realize that they flow not on causal logic, but a sort of emotive or affectative or dream logic. And, you know, especially that opening scene, or a couple of scenes where you're sort of doing the fade to white and going back to memories. Like, I feel like this film would have worked a bit better if it maintained that sort of flow to it. But yeah, like, that is some of the most effective aspects of the film. It's just kind of a shame that we didn't see more of it, which I guess brings us to my second hit, shame we didn't see more of. I have to say, out of a very strong cast giving good performances, every time I watch this movie, I fall in love with Anthony Perkins all over again.
Yeah,
because he is just so pleasant. There is something like very Charlie Brown-esque about him and his performance as the chaplain. And again, he doesn't have a tremendous amount of character, but he really does feel the most like an actual human being.
No, absolutely. And I mean, I think that's one of the big takeaways is the more and more I explore, you know, Anthony Perkins' body of work outside of Psycho itself and its sequels there, the more it's really clear he got a raw deal from Hollywood, because he was capable of so much more and could have been delivering performances of this tier in films far more worthy of his time on a regular basis. And again, that's not to say that he had a terrible career. I would say many people would kill to have had the career he had. But, you know, once Norman Bates happened to him, I mean, he got stuck. And it's unfortunate. It really is, because the work he does in this film is just superb. The work he's done in things like The Trial is just superb. Like, he's just a magnificent actor and really, really does deserve far more of people's attention as well. So if nothing else, go back to check out Anthony Perkins' work in this movie.
And unfortunately, as life is a part of death, as combat is a part of conflict, okay, whatever. Sour in the sweet, here are the things that we were not big fans of. These are the pits. Dave, I know we've articulated a lot of areas where this film kind of goes off the rails or stumbles a bit, but are there any particular things that you would like to point out as a pit?
It's one of those things where I understand why this wouldn't be here, but I really wish there was more Bob Newhart in this film, because yeah, the scenes he has are just like, Bob Newhart's a joy to watch in anything that's out there, even in, you know, In and Out, when we watched that a few months back, he's delightful in that movie. And here, you know, he is delightful as this put upon, I don't want to be here, middle management schmuck in the midst of all this. And I honestly could have done seen a whole lot more of him throughout this film, even if it was just,
well, like, especially him playing off of Norman Fell, who is one of the all-time great deadpanners.
Yeah.
It works to great effect with the script that they have.
Well, absolutely. And even if it had been like just even a running gag in the background, if you just see like Bob Newhart in the background of scenes, just sort of tiptoeing around, avoiding people, and doing his best not to be seen by anybody who would actually have a question for him. Like, you wouldn't even need to necessarily see him interacting with people on the scene, but just the, even just the acknowledgement that, yeah, Major is out there, and he is still determined not to have a conversation with you, would have been just, you know, something delightful to have seen throughout this. That, is that getting probably a bit slapsticky for this film? I will admit. I'm also not against that in this instance, but that's my first pit. What about you, Andrew?
I think I've outlined most of my main objections, maybe too big of a cast to know what to do with. The fact that this is, you know, a male-driven film, and there are moments where, for narrative effect, it lapses into misogyny, but it still does that regardless. I think on the whole, the problem is, you know, as I said, it's just... I think there are certainly reasons why there's this tension between, are you making a movie about the book? Are you making a movie that's also speaking to some greater point? Are you making a movie that speaks to Vietnam and contemporary warfare? And I don't think the film ever really locks into a mode where it chooses, and that causes a lot more rupture to the film than I think is necessary. The way I see it is if you, generally, if you come to the end of a film and you get the sense that the ending is symbolic, but you're not sure what is actually being evoked through the symbolism, there may be a problem in terms of structure. And again, I think Nichols and company come by it honestly. You know, they certainly had a difficult task ahead of them. And I don't want to say that, well, and it makes total sense why the film failed, because I think it succeeds much more than it does fail. And unfortunately, though, maybe just the pit was trying to adapt such a cultural touchstone of a novel, because especially to do it with another war on the horizon, you're basically accepting that you're not going to please everybody.
Yeah, no, it definitely makes sense. And I mean, and it's the thing, I get it. And I mean, it's certainly, it's not like this, you know, sabotaged Mike Nichols' career, because he was able to go on and achieve great heights afterwards, along with a few lows out there as well.
Yeah. But I think also at 2 hours long, the film does feel a bit long in the tooth, maybe owing to the vignette structure, and maybe owing to the fact that, again, as we've said, 2021, it's easy to see the main premise or the main thesis of war is a pretty absurd thing as almost banal, even a moot point by now. But again, you can kind of understand why it is the way that it is. And for the most part, you can appreciate it, too.
Exactly. So, I mean, again, worth checking out. It's available for rental. I think the Criterion Channel occasionally has it up. I wasn't there the last time I was taking a look, but you have your options for finding the movie in order to check it out.
Yes, war may be hell, but there are still moments where you can chuckle on the gallows or whistle a little bit on the elevator ride down. And, yeah, speaking of the afterlife, that's got me thinking about what comes next, and now that's Dave's turn to tell us where our show is going to be going next.
Well, we're not done with Mike Nichols yet. Now, you might sit there and say, oh, you're going to take a look at Closer, right? No, we're not taking a look at Closer.
Good, I hated that movie.
Yeah. Are you going to watch The Graduate? No, we're not going to watch The Graduate. Instead, we're going to go to 1994 for the little film that a few people tend to forget, and that is Jack Nicholson, Michelle Pfeiffer, and James Spader in Mike Nichols' Wolf. Yes. The werewolf movie set in the publishing industry, folks. Also including Christopher Plummer.
That's what it's about?
It's in the publishing industry, and it also has David Hyde Pierce and Christopher Plummer in it as well. This is going to be a doozy of a conversation here, okay, folks.
Well, you've sold me. I remember being a kid at the video store and being like, why is Jack Nicholson turning into a wolf man on that poster? I don't think I've even seen a trailer from this film, but that poster is etched into my brain. So it'll be interesting to see the celluloid behind the silk print, as it were. Okay, so Wolf, we are it's going to be a hair-raising experience.
Indeed.
I promise I'll come up with better ones for that episode. In the meantime, though, Dave, where can people get in touch with you for a big welcome back or a big, you guys made us wait a month for this?
Well, I'm just going to say that people from the estate of Mr. Joseph Heller, who would like to yell at me for being disrespectful towards his work, can yell at me at 24 panels. What about you, Andrew? Where can they reach you?
Heller wants a yeller. I'm his feller. You can get in touch with me on Twitter at FilmStripper, or you can email the show directly at FilmStripsPodcast@gmail.com. Sorry, Scotiabank Theater, I do not have your debit card. You keep emailing us. I'm going to need a little bit more before I sign up on that interest rate. But if you are interested, in leaving us a review, you can do so on whatever podcatching service you use. Normally, Apple Music is the one that we look at, but 5-star reviews are nice. They help move us up the charts and get us featured. But more importantly, that's your opportunity to let us know how the show's treating you. What do you like? What do you hate? What do you want us to do? And what wacky characters do you want us to revive? All I know is that in spite of a rapidly changing world and coming up on 3 years, Dave and I have only wanted to do one simple thing, and that's bring you a show that you want to listen to.
Indeed. And on that note, Andrew, do you have any parting words for our listeners at home?
Oh, Dave, you know for a fact I do. Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Now, if you had Hawkeye and Trapper John with you, maybe that wouldn't be such an issue now, would it? Bye, folks.